Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. This program is brought to you by People to People, an Ethiopian diaspora volunteer healthcare organization. The show airs every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You may tune in by using the link provided on the P2B website or by dialing 646-595-4742. Press 2 when prompted to listen and press 1 when prompted to speak. You can also email your questions and comments to info@peoplepeople.org. Today is March 20th, 2014. I'm your host, Dr. Lydia Tesfa. My guest this evening is Professor Delahun Yilma, who is a veterinary virologist at the University of California, Davis, who genetically engineered a vaccine for a deadly cattle disease called Rinderpest. Rinderpest is an acute infectious viral disease of cattle, which has killed millions of cattle in Africa. Dr. Delahun earned a bachelor's degree in veterinary science in 1968, a doctor of veterinary medicine degree in 1970, and a doctoral degree in microbiology in 1977 from the University of California, Davis. Dr. Delahun is a recipient of numerous awards, including the prestigious Teaching and Faculty Research Awards from the University of California. In addition, in 1995, he received a Distinguished Public Service Award from the same university. Dr. Delahun has published numerous scientific articles and peer-reviewed journals. Dr. Delahun, it's a pleasure and an honor to have you with us. Welcome to our radio show.
Thank you.
Dr. Delahun, you have been at the forefront of efforts that have been done to combat one of the most deadly cattle diseases ever seen. You've been involved in generating vaccines as well as producing effective diagnostic tools. I'll ask you about these topics a little bit later in the show. I'd like to open our discussion by asking you to describe to us what Rinderpest is, what causes it, and the symptoms that are associated with it.
Rinderpest is a viral disease. It's recognized probably way back in 300 AD, and it has caused devastating disease. In the 1800s, Europe got it, supposedly from Asia. In the 18th century alone, in Europe, over 200 million cattle perished from this particular disease. So to combat this viral disease, which kills cattle by sloughing their stomach, mouth, all the what we call the GI tract, the entire gastrointestinal tract, and then they die within 6 to 10 days with bloody diarrhea, and usually mortality exceeds 95%, particularly in European cattle, it's virtually 100%. So in the 18th century, when over 200 million cattle perished, the first veterinary school in France in 1962, the first international congress of veterinarians to combat this disease in Germany in 1862 or 4, and then the establishment of the International Epizootic Office, which is OIE, the Office of International Epizootics in Paris in France in 1924, and the first major international disease eradication program in the 60s called Joint Program 15 or JP15, all major events in veterinary medicine have taken place in an attempt to control and eradicate this disease.
Hmm. As you've mentioned, in the 18th century alone, the disease had killed millions of cattle in Europe. And also in 1888, 90% of cattle population in Ethiopia also perished due to this disease. Would you mind taking us back to history and tell us how this disease got introduced in Ethiopia, in particular in Africa?
Okay, I think especially with regard to Ethiopia, the first attempt of Italy to conquer and colonize Ethiopia, and so they wanted to facilitate this process of colonization. So they were received a gift of three cattle in history. This is, by the way, beautifully documented in two volumes written by Richard Pankhurst in the Journal of the History of Medicine. And so I am directly referring from Richard Pankhurst's work, who is a foremost Ethiopian historian, as you know.
Yes.
Sylvia Pankhurst's son. So these three cattle were introduced around 1888 through the port of Massawa, deliberately used to weaken Menelik's army by introducing this disease. So almost close to 90% of all ruminants, the definition would be cattle, sheep and goats, wild buffaloes, small gazelles, just name it, all these ruminant animals just perished as a result of this particular disease. And of course, especially in the 1800s, in the 19th century, cattle is essential for farming, for fiber, for milk. It is important for the livestock industry, particularly where there are a lot of nomadic populations in the nation. And as a result, it is estimated that 30 to 60% of the Ethiopian population starved to death. And so you'll probably be too young, but while I was growing up in Ethiopia, we had a special commemoration of this particular event. It is described in our calendars. It is noted as Yekaptilkit, the annihilation of cattle. So this is a very, very important, very significant period in the history of Ethiopia. In fact, I remember when I went to visit, we had a farm in Dukam. And if I asked my grandmother how old she was, she would say she was 12 years old during the annihilation of cattle. So this was a historical reference point in Ethiopian history.
When I was reading your bibliography, I read somewhere that when you finished your first degree that you went back to Ethiopia to have some experience. Can you tell us about that experience that you had with the nomadic herders in Ethiopia?
Yes. In fact, I owe all my education to Rinderfest. I remember finishing Jimma, Agricultural Technical High School, where your dad was the director at the time. And I went to Alamaya. And then when I was in Alamaya, I just had completed, before I just completed 2 years, a USAID person by the name of Jake Harishberger came to the college and wanted to recruit students who have a high GPA and have a good chance of getting accepted in veterinary school in the United States. As you know, it's very difficult to get into a veterinary school program. The competition is stiff, and they don't take too many foreign students.
Mm-hmm.
So from my second year from Alamaya, I think that was the first time that was done, I was sent to the United States, came to University of California, Davis. The entire purpose of this was for me to get my degree in veterinary medicine, get trained, and return back and participate in this major international program to eradicate the disease. So I was sent to the United States. As soon as I completed my training, I returned back to Addis, and then I was sent to Jimma to be in charge of the joint program, or JP15 Rinderpest Eradication Program, for the province of Harar that would include Ogaden and that region. So there were a lot of international people from France. France was particularly involved in Harar. So we would drive in British Land Rovers all over Harargeh province through the Ogaden. We vaccinated millions and millions of cattle. This is a heat labile vaccine developed by the British veterinarian Plowright in Kenya. And so we had to contain the vaccine in kerosene refrigerators, travel all over Ogaden, and we vaccinated millions and millions of cattle. I had a colleague from France, Jean-Philippe Blanc, who is a French veterinarian. We worked together. Both of us, our Land Rover broke down. We were stranded in the desert without food and water. We barely escaped with our lives. That's another story. But by the time we completed the JP15 program in East Africa, we had vaccinated something like a total of, at the end of JP15, Joint Program 15, we vaccinated a total of 124 million cattle. And rinderpest was considered eradicated. Commemorative stamps were issued. There were celebrations at the end of that program. By the way, there was another attempt to eradicate rinderpest in the 40s, was considered eradicated, came back, and then that was the second attempt to eradicate rinderpest.
You've talked about the success of this joint program, I guess. It's an international cooperative effort that was done under the auspices of the African Union. I would like to ask you about was it successful, 100% successful, or were they failures associated with it?
You know, initially, yes, it was eradicated. It was successful. But unfortunately, the whole program was run by international organizations, mainly British, French, Canadian, a few U.S. U.S. gave a lot of the money. USAID provided something like $30 million.
Yeah.
What happens is the vaccine is produced, was produced at Debrazate. It's a heat labile vaccine. It's very expensive to produce, very expensive to maintain its stability because it's heat labile. And therefore, when the international organizations left, there was really not extensive infrastructure developed so that the people there could carry on monitoring that the disease did not return back.
Hmm.
The other major problem, to be very honest, with eradicating this disease was it also affected all wild ruminants, for example, buffalo, wildebeest. All these animals are affected by rinderpest. So there was no way you can vaccinate these animals. So eventually the disease returned back from wild animals back to cattle. And so that's how the third eradication program called PARC, Pan-African Rinderpest Campaign, was initiated. It just got completed. There was a recent celebration of eradication of the disease. So also, there's a lot of money involved in the eradication program. There is, especially the old colonial powers, French and British, are heavily involved in this. They have a laboratory called Pirbright in England, which is totally dedicated in making vaccines for rinderpest, for tropical diseases of in the old colonial power. Similarly, the French have a similar laboratory that produces vaccines and diagnostic tests. And these laboratories are dependent selling products to developing countries or former colonial countries. So there was a major, major financial interest in the old colonial powers from really developing an infrastructure that after they've left, the people themselves can carry on the vaccination program. In fact, when we tried to establish laboratories in Senegal, laboratories in Kenya, laboratories in Ethiopia, the kind of resistance and sabotage we faced from the British and the French was just totally unbelievable.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm writing a book about that, by the way.
Mm-hmm. So although the Ethiopian scientists then they were aware about the cost of these expensive vaccines or the desirable effect of these vaccines, they were not able to do anything at all just because a lot of money was, being considered from these, donor countries. So what was their feeling, the Ethiopian counterparts? I'm sure they were aware.
To give credit, at the beginning, when the United States again was asked to contribute money for the third eradication program, they pretty much resisted. They asked the National Science Foundation, NSF, to have a consultation, and they invited William Pritchard, the former dean of the veterinary school here at UC Davis, chaired, and they had experts looking at whether United States should again participate and contribute money for the third attempt to eradicate this disease.
Mm-hmm.
The conclusion was, instead of wasting our time and effort going through this never-ending Rinderpest eradication program, why don't we develop a vaccine that actually addresses the logistical problems that were associated in permanent eradication of the program, such as heat stability of the vaccine, being able to distinguish between vaccinated and infected animals, because once you vaccinate the animals, they would have the antibody to the virus.
Yeah.
So if you want to export these animals, especially to Europe, to other places, then they're barred from the export market because they wouldn't know whether this is as a result of infection or vaccination.
Yeah.
So they wanted to develop a vaccine that is heat stable, easy to produce, cheap to produce, that you can even give it at the earliest age in the presence of maternal antibody, which interferes with vaccination, and then able to distinguish vaccinated from infected animals. That way you can export, you can vaccinate the animals and export it. And when, in fact, I am the one, when they said that they really need to address the issue, I went to USAID, made a proposal to USAID. At that time, there was a young scientist who was in charge of USAID program that came from Rockefeller University, Carrie Ann Jones. Now she is Assistant Secretary of State in the State Department
mm-hmm.
for Science and Technology. And so I went over there and I said, I have a plan to do this. So I made a seminar presentation. It was the vaccinia virus recombinant. It was a new technology. I had learned it from the inventor, Bernie Moss, at the National Institute of Health in Bethesda, Maryland. And I said, I could use this vaccine. I could develop the diagnostic kit. I can make a heat-stable vaccine. In fact, I can make a vaccine that the people themselves, the farmers themselves, can grow their vaccine and can produce it and use it. And they were really excited about this, and initially they gave me an $800,000 grant to work on this vaccine. And within a year, I developed the vaccine. It was a paper published in Science, and there was just an uproar from the former colonial powers, especially Britain and French. They started using, this is dangerous, this is molecular biology, this is genetic engineering. They really created, so there was more problem getting the vaccine out than there was developing it.
Yeah. Which brings me to my next question, which was, the lack of efficacy of these conventional vaccines led to your research that you were referring to right now. And I think you also had an international, or you have an international laboratory of molecular biology where you're the director of. You've developed several of these vaccines. and which you already mentioned, these are the vaccinia virus recombinant vaccines. Could you please briefly describe to us what these vaccinia virus recombinant vaccines are, and how does your lab uses the recombinant vaccine technology these to generate these vaccine strains? If you could briefly describe those two.
Sure. This is actually pretty clever how this was resurrected. And the interesting thing was that, as you know, the first truly eradicated disease. Now, it was eradicated. The last time we saw anything like that was in 1978 in Somalia. Since then, we have never seen this disease. It has vanished. Mm-hmm. That is the smallpox vaccine, which we call Fantata in Amharic.
Uh-huh.
And when I grew up, smallpox was worldwide, it was a very devastating disease, especially Varroa major had a mortality rate about 33%, and it disfigures people's face with the pock lesions that create these scars on the face of especially, you know, young people, young women with prospects to marry. And I remember in Nazareth, young women who were just totally, their face was disfigured from smallpox, and the parents were just devastated because it's really a very, if you survive it, it permanently disfigures you. So the way it was eradicated was, it goes back to the 1700s, but even before that, people knew that if they took the scab from a pock lesion, dried it up, used that to scratch, you could significantly reduce the mortality, like from 30-40% down to 1% or something.
Yeah.
Yet, these people would be permanently protected from the disease. This is called variolization. Chinese practiced it, Turks, Ethiopians, for thousands of years. In fact, one of the pharaohs had these pock lesions. If you look at the pharaohs, you can see that. I think he was Ramses the Fifth. I forgot. He had these pock lesions on his face. So this is an old scourge.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, the way that was eradicated was Jenner noticed in the 1700s that when they had these major outbreaks of smallpox, the only people that didn't get it were milkmaids. And he was people who were milking cows, whose profession was to milk cows. And he noticed the reason they were protected was they were getting cows get cowpox on the tits of the udder, on the areas that is not covered with hair. So when they get infected with the cowpox virus, they were being protected from smallpox because these orthopox viruses cross-protect each other. So that's what the cowpox vaccination started. Before you know it, people start using horsepox, cowpox. But at the end, somehow a virus appeared called vaccinia. It's not cowpox, not smallpox, but with all this mixing, everybody using vaccinia virus appeared. It's a pox virus. It's an orthopox virus. It's never been associated with a virus. So they use that to eradicate smallpox worldwide, simply because you don't need to refrigerate it. You can just scrub it on the abdomen, shave the abdomen of a calf, apply that virus, take the scab from a single calf, you can use it for 200,000 doses of vaccine. It's stable. You don't need to refrigerate it. So that's how smallpox was eradicated. So Bernie Moss at NIH and Enzo Paoletti also, when genetic engineering came, how about splicing the genes that are protective, say for rinderpest, the genes that are protective from any other diseases, splice it into this vaccinia virus. Then when you scratch with that vaccinia virus, not only would you be protected against smallpox, but you would also be protected against all these the genes of this virus you've spliced in. So we took two important genes from rinderpest virus that are essential for providing you protective immunity. These are called the fusion gene and the hemagglutinin gene. So we cloned those genes from rinderpest virus. we splice it through molecular biology into vaccinia virus, into the smallpox vaccine virus. That's how we develop this recombinant vaccine. So it has the feature of heat stability, easy propagation in calves, but at the same time, you can produce tons of this vaccine.
And then how safe are these vaccines, especially if you're splicing the genes? How do you know they are not pathogenic?
We actually tested this in all kinds of animals, including, luckily, I had a major program working on HIV here. We have a primate center, not directly with the HIV virus, but using a model called simian immunodeficiency virus. This is the HIV virus of monkeys.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the HIV virus of monkeys, injected it into a whole bunch of macaques, monkeys, and then gave them this virus. They were absolutely safe. It did not spread. If you give under normal circumstances vaccinia virus, especially if they have the HIV, it just overwhelms them. However, this particular virus was extremely safe. And then USDA, United States Department of Agriculture, took it, did what is called a safety test, or a test to make sure that it is safe. They certified it to be safe. There was not even a complication of 1 in a billion to use this vaccine.
Interesting. And we say it's a very safe vaccine. And
right.
How long does the effect last? Does it last for a short period of time, or does it last for 2-3 years? Because we would want to have a vaccine that would have an effect for a longer period of time.
You know, that's a very important question you asked, Lydia. The length of the protective immunity of the vaccine when you use vaccinia virus does not depend on the vaccinia virus. It depends on the genes that you spliced.
Mm-hmm.
For example, if you vaccinate for rinderpest with the standard tissue culture vaccine, the attenuated live vaccine, they protect it for life. So if you took the genes from rinderpest virus, you spliced it into vaccinia virus, they protect it for life.
Yeah.
Now, if you take foot and mouth disease, we've also done this with foot and mouth disease. Foot and mouth disease does not provide a long-term protection. If you splice the foot and mouth disease VP1 protein into vaccinia, you can protect them for 3 months. Like every 3 months, you have to revaccinate. So the determinant factor, how long a vaccinated person or animal is going to be protected, depends on the original gene you isolated from that particular virus. If rinderpest classical vaccine, like tissue culture vaccine, provides protective immunity for life, then if you splice those genes into vaccinia, you get protection for life. So that is dependent on the rinderpest virus and not dependent on the vaccinia virus. To give you an example is, for example, you had to make a presentation, say, in Addis Ababa, and you are, say, an HIV expert, you're invited, you're going to go give a presentation, say, at Addis Ababa University.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you travel from the United States on United or on Lufthansa or on any other airlines, it's not going to determine the content of your presentation so long as you arrive there. So vaccinia virus is just a carrier.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It does not change the trait of that particular gene you spliced.
Mm-hmm.
So if rinderpest gives you a lifelong protection, if you take those genes, splice them into vaccine, you get a lifelong protection.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
And how easy is it to propagate this this vaccine?
Okay. It's very, very simple. You can use many ways of propagating it. For example, if you have tissue culture facilities, you can propagate it in tissue culture facilities, just like you propagate rinderpest in tissue culture. Rinderpest, the classical vaccines, the tissue culture vaccines, you can propagate it in tissue culture. You can also, the vaccinia virus recombinant vaccine, you can propagate it in tissue culture.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you don't have tissue culture facilities, all you have to do is get a calf, shave the abdomen of the calf, remove all the hair, you know, clip it off, and then you wash it clean with soap, and you make sure that you use alcohol, you clean it very nice, and then you scarify it, meaning you scratch it with some instrument to sort of slightly cut into the skin. Then you apply the seed virus on the stomach, on the shaved area. You cover it with gauze. You keep the animal for a week. The virus would grow on the skin of the abdomen of the calf. Then you scrape the scab. The scab, you remove the scab. Then that you can either dry it and keep it for years, or if you want, you can suspend it in water, or you can suspend it in saline water, whatever you like.
Yeah.
And then all you have to do is take a dip. You can immunize by scratching. You could immunize by feeding it. You could immunize by injecting it.
Mm-hmm.
Any way you want.
Wow. So I would think that we will have a lot of African countries that are currently employing your method, which I guess I'll come to that question a little bit later. In terms that refers to a technology transfer.
Right.
I would like you to wait a little bit before I get into that question. One last question before I open up the podium for audience. How do you administer, or in other words, what's the route of administration of this vaccine?
Okay, like I said, you can just take, have it in a bottle, take it. You see, I think you're probably too young to have been vaccinated for smallpox. When I was a kid in Ethiopia, the vaccinators came, they have a needle, they dip into the vaccine, and they scratch, little scratch until you saw a little blood. Then that forms a scab, the scab falls off, and then you have this marker on your shoulder where you were vaccinated for smallpox. So
uh-huh.
You can use a scratch, it's called intradermal application, or you can also inject it subcutaneously under the skin, or you can inject it intramuscularly in the muscle,
yeah.
Or you can, in fact, we were trying to develop vaccine by incorporating it into pellets of alfalfa. So when you
mm-hmm.
give it to animals by feeding to vaccinate.
Oh, alfalfa is a plant.
Alfalfa is a regular plant that you use for feed for animals.
Uh-huh.
You could use any kind of other feeds, sort of dry the vaccine, incorporate it with the feed, and feed it to them. For example, this is how now rabies is being eradicated both in the United States and Europe. It's using
mm-hmm.
the same vaccinia virus where one of the genes from rabies called the glycoprotein gene, G gene, is spliced, and then that is put into a bait of fish or any kind of meat. It's dropped from planes throughout into the forest for wild animals, wild foxes, raccoons to eat it. When they eat it, while they
yeah.
get immunized against rabies. So this the other vaccine side by side that were developed was for rabies, and this was being dropped by planes on millions of acres of land to
mm-hmm.
eradicate wild rabies using this principle.
Before I go to my other questions, I'd like to give a chance to our audience to ask questions. I'd like to give the podium to a number, 845-558. Could you please press 1 then and go ahead?
Could
is there anybody?
Yes, it's me.
Hello.
This?
Hello. I can hear you.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Could you tell us your name and ask your question?
Okay. Am I connected to you or not?
Yes, you are. I'm hearing you. Can you hear me?
Okay. I want to know who you are, Dr. Tlaun or?
Yes. That's me.
Okay. Do you know Owen Wood?
Who?
Owen Wood. Owen Wood.
No.
Who's this?
Okay, I think...
I'm sorry.
Hello?
I think that might have been a wrong call.
Okay, maybe we could go to the next question.
Yes, let's go to the next
question. No, I'm going to ask him. Actually, right.
I'm sorry, could you introduce your name, please?
Okay, I'm Dr. Asfaw. Because I know about him, about Professor Tlaun, when you spoke about the rabies vaccine, how it was smuggled from Ethiopia, I thought you knew Owen Wood.
No, I don't.
Wood. Okay, you don't recognize him?
No.
Sir, can you go ahead and ask the question? I'm sorry. We are short of time, and we would like to give other people a chance as well. Could you please pose your question, if you don't mind?
The question is actually, I didn't have any question. I was inquiring information on how this rabies vaccine went to the, how they smuggled it. I knew how it happened. Dr. Brown didn't know it. I'm sorry. I think I'll ask a question another time.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'd like to go to the next caller. It's 703-625. Can you please press 1, please, and go ahead? Hello?
Hello.
Is there a caller? Oh, maybe he might have been disconnected. Dr. Delon,
okay.
Let me go to my next question while we wait for the caller.
Okay.
So you have generated a number of strains, vaccine strains, that could be applicable for rinderpest. And you were referring in your previous statements that these vaccines should be able to distinguish infection from infected from a vaccinated
animal.
Yes. So these strains that you've generated, will they be able to distinguish vaccinated from infected?
Yes, they will. And in fact, in a ceremony, I think I sent you the picture.
Yes.
All the recombinant vaccines, all the diagnostic kits that I developed, I transferred to Africa. We didn't get when I was offered a position with University of California from Washington State, one of the conditions I moved was that anything that was developed in my laboratory was going to be given to Africa for free.
Mm-hmm.
And so I transferred. There was a beautiful person. He passed away, Joseph Saar, Ambassador Kenneth Brill, who is the U.S. ambassador to Austria and to the International Atomic Energy. He was very, very generous, gave me $250,000 to transfer the program to Africa. So we started a program in Senegal,
mm-hmm.
In Dakar. We developed the diagnostic test. That, in fact, I really need to talk a little bit about the diagnostic test.
Oh, yeah. I will come
if
to that question.
That would be okay with you.
Yeah, definitely.
The diagnostic test is, say, for vaccination, we use two of the genes, the H and the F.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are internal protein called nucleoprotein that wraps around the gene of the virus, the RNA of the virus. We took that nucleoprotein. We use that to distinguish between vaccinated and infected. The,
mm-hmm.
the vaccinated animals would only be positive to H and F. The infected animals would be positive to all the viral proteins, including the N, the nucleoprotein.
Yeah.
So what we did was we took the nucleoprotein, we made an ELISA or a dipstick test, a very simple test to distinguish if they're positive to N, they're infected. If they're negative to N, they're not infected. Very simple. Now,
yeah.
the diagnostic test that the British and the French were selling, they were using international organization, $10,000. What they were selling for $10,000, the antigen they were selling for $10,000, we can produce it in larvae for less than 5 cents.
Hmm.
And that really, really made them very unhappy because we developed the test. See, while we were making the vaccine, there were one of the things that I honestly did was when I went to Kenya, it was a horrible comment that Africans cannot make scientists. And I really wanted to dismiss this ridiculous claim. So I established the International Laboratory of Molecular Biology here at UC Davis. The entire purpose of it was because I wasn't able to return to Ethiopia, I thought maybe I can make contributions here. So I worked on relevant problems to tropical regions. So what I did was, in addition to making the vaccine, I recruited people from Kenya, I recruited people from Ethiopia, from Senegal, from all parts of Africa, brought them to my laboratory, trained them in molecular biology, and then when they went back to their country, helped them build a small laboratory. We built a nice lab in Senegal. We supported a little molecular biology lab in Debre, Ethiopia, one in Kenya. So basically the idea was you give a person a fish, you give them a meal for a day, you teach them how to fish, you make them dependent for the rest, independent for the rest of their life. So the idea of not only producing these vaccines and diagnostic kits that are relevant to Africa, but also training African scientists, this has really created a lot of conflict in the former colonial powers, which really want to continue to sell these things to Africa. So one of the techniques we used was there is this larvae of a silk virus. So if you inject this baculovirus, kills this particular worm, and that particular larvae then, almost 60% of it converts into the polyhedron protein of this virus. So we eliminated the polyhedron gene and substituted into the virus the nuclear protein gene. So when we inject it into the larvae, while the larvae, 60% of it becomes the nuclear protein of rinderpest. So you can actually grind a single larvae, be able to have enough antigen to do 10 to 60,000 serum samples in duplicate. And a single larvae won't even cost you 5 cents, and you don't need any refrigeration. So this was a very powerful technology, thanks to Ambassador Kenneth Brill, the American ambassador to Austria, and to the International Atomic Energy with the money he gave me. We were able to train about 60 people from 30 different laboratories. We had a workshop. We showed that people who were trained in my lab went back, were able to train other Africans from different regions. So we had this workshop. It was very, very successful. But it really created a lot of contention in the colonial powers.
So if I understood it correctly, so you take crude lysates of these insect cells, and then you use that as a
coating antigen on an ELISA plate.
So ELISA would be.
We also use, you know, the pregnancy test, that little dipstick pregnancy test that people use on urine.
Yeah.
We made exactly one for peste de petite ruminants, for rinderpest, for vesicular stomatitis virus. So if you are in the field, you don't have a ELISA plate, you can actually have one of those little papers that are embedded with the antigen, with the antibody. You can just stick it, get a color reaction, and be able to do a diagnosis.
So was that the workshop that you did back, I think it's in Africa, where you
it was in Senegal.
Oh, okay. Can you tell us about that workshop, basically how, what type of students you had, and how these students in turn brought that technology back to their country? So if you could talk about that workshop.
I was lucky to have really some wonderful people who are able to, because these colonial powers are very powerful. They have penetrated all the international organizations. They're in the UN organization, FAO, International Atomic Energy. So they work you up. So basically, Ambassador Kenneth Brill, who was the U.S. ambassador to the International Atomic Energy, the International Atomic Energy had a technology transfer section that was led by a very brilliant and very, very helpful Chinese Deputy Director General. This person was Mr. Chen. And so Mr. Chen and I became very good friends. He supported me. And then in the U.S. Embassy, we had Ira Goldman and Tom Tissue, and then Ambassador Kenneth Brill. He gave me $250,000, and they sort of helped me politically as well. So I was able to bring people from Africa, train them in my lab. They can go back. And then with the money that was given to me by Ambassador Brill, we had this one-week-long workshop where people came from 30 different laboratories, two individuals from all parts of Africa came to Dakar, and it was Africans who were trained in my lab, trained these Africans, taught them how to do it, and there was a graduation ceremony. And then when they left, they also had the seed virus. They have the packet, everything with them to go home. There was a person from Ghana by the name of George. He made a very, during the celebration, the Minister of Science and Technology for Senegal gave the certificates of training. During that ceremony, George turned around. He said, Professor Yilma, have you noticed something? And I was surprised. I said, George, I don't know what you're referring to. He said, well, this is the first time where African scientists developed the vaccine and the diagnostic kits. African scientists taught other Africans, and then those other Africans taught other Africans. It was totally an African show. They were very, very, very proud that they were capable of doing this, and they can do it all by themselves from the beginning to the end.
Yeah, that's very impressive.
It really was. I mean, it was just like a dream come true because, you know, they've been beaten up. You can't do this on your own. You need assistance. You need foreign aid, blah, 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 blah. Here, the leader of the team was an African. The scientists who came to be trained were Africans. These African scientists who were trained in my lab went back to Africa, conducted the workshop for 60 other Africans, and all that was distributed. And for George to notice that, he said, you know, Africans, he said, this was totally an African show. In fact, we were going to have another workshop in Asia where African scientists were going to go do it, but there was so much resistance from this international organization, we weren't able to do that. We were thinking of doing another workshop, in this case, taking Africans who were trained in Africa and training Asians, and there would be a technology transfer from Africa to Asia.
Yeah. So are you going to do one in the future? I know you said that it might be hard to do that, but it is a very beneficial workshop that a lot of people could benefit. Are you planning to have one?
Well, you know, at this point, I have major family issues. So now I have focused. By the way, if you look at all this work that was done by Africans in my lab, I was the first to be elected to the National Academy of Science from the School of Veterinary Medicine. It's over a 60-year-old school. It's considered number one and number two in the world. So so here are African scientists at Purdue got me elected to the most prestigious National Academy of Science. We received the Sibagagi Award. Our picture was in the Smithsonian for making major contributions to U.S. agriculture, 100-year celebration. Our lab was referred to. So you can see that if given the right environment, the right condition, forget about waging war, ethnic strife, forget all that, take all our resources. If we work focused on work, there is nothing that African scientists are not capable of doing.
I agree. And before I go to my few last questions, I'd like to see if we have any callers in. If not, I'd like to ask you a little bit about your other works that you've been working on. I know that you've been working in designing vaccines against HIV, and also you briefly mentioned the I'm sorry, I forgot the disease, the mouse, you called it.
Vesicular stomatitis virus.
Yes, yes.
We published that in Science. We just finished making a wonderful vaccine for Rift Valley fever. We would like to get it, to take it out into Africa when, current issues are settled. I would like to take it to Africa. So we've completed making a vaccine for Rift Valley fever. We've really done a lot of work on SIV, using simian immunodeficiency virus for vaccine. For example, if it is our laboratory the first to show that you cannot really make a vaccine to prevent infection, you could only make a vaccine to reduce virus load. There is no that information, which is considered a significant discovery in the HIV field, was done in our lab.
So what do you mean by that?
If we vaccinate with the Rinderpest vaccine, we challenge them with Rinderpest virus, they completely eliminate the virus.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you vaccinate with HIV vaccine or with the monkey HIV vaccine, and you challenge them to see whether they're protected or not, it will never prevent infection. The animals will be infected, but the amount of virus that is in their body would be very, very low.
Mm-hmm.
So the term for that is used is it reduces virus load, but it never really prevents the establishment of the virus infection.
Mm-hmm. One other technical question. You were referring to macaques, and how significant are macaques in your studies? I guess my question would be why you chose macaques for your study rather than mice model?
Right, because HIV, infects humans, and obviously you cannot use humans as experimental animals. So basically, SIV, the simian immunodeficiency virus, does exactly virtually identical the way it infects monkeys, the way it makes them immunocompromised, the way it attacks the CD4 cells, the T lymphocytes, CD4 cells, just like humans. Because of the destruction of CD4 cells, that's why these animals become immunodeficient. They have nothing to protect them from infection. It's not the virus that really kills them, that the virus kills the main central immune cell, which is the CD4 cell. As a result, you become susceptible to any kind of infection that is not normally dangerous to that animal. So if you look at the CD4 destruction by the virus, being immunodeficient, if you look at the whole sequence of events that takes place when humans get infected with HIV, is virtually identical when SIV infects macaques. So macaques become a very good model to study pathogenesis, how the virus infects and kills cells, to evaluate drugs to prevent the infection, to evaluate vaccines to prevent the infection. All these various things could actually be worked out and developed in the macaque. Then once you figured out what's the best way to do it in macaques, then you can apply that HIV for human use.
So can the SIV virus infect human cells?
SIV virus can infect, but it doesn't really cause disease. We're very careful we don't get infected by it. HIV-1, for example, does not infect macaques. However, it would infect chimpanzees, HIV-1. HIV-2, the second kind of HIV, is actually much more similar to the simian immunodeficiency virus. So these are highly related viruses called lentiviruses, and they are specific for a given species of animals.
I guess we don't have any callers. I'm winding up my questions unless you want to say something.
I think I just want to make a few remarks.
Please go ahead.
With regard, since we both come from Africa and you and I from Ethiopia, I just like to our listeners, just imagine the billions of dollars we have spent just to fighting colonial boundaries. If you consider the war between, say, Eritrea, Ethiopia, or all these things, it's just the same group of people, the billions of dollars that are spent in waging war. We could have built universities, we could have built roads, we could have built schools. So that should really be the emphasis, is if there was just a way we could focus on really productive stuff, like educating our people, fighting disease, building roads, building hospitals. That should be really the emphasis. So, and I think in this, when I established the International Laboratory of Molecular Biology, because of the problem that was going in Ethiopia, I wasn't able to go back. So I decided, what can I do over here that would be relevant to the region? That's really why I established this laboratory and have been able to train a lot of people. And the emphasis I really like to make is, if African scientists could come and flourish and do really outstanding work, be competitive at the world stage, is there any reason why we cannot do it in our own environment where we have our own family support? So we really need to focus and think how we can change the directions so that millions of people do not suffer from waging war, instead of spending all these billions of dollars buying this, you know, a single tank that cost $1 million, could be used to build an elementary school. So this is the really things that I'd like to focus on. Currently, I chair the Board of International Science of the National Academies. Through the National Academies, I have addressed this issue, and I have even written articles on it. I think that's going to be the next phase of my life, is really working on technology transfer, reducing conflict, and focusing, using your resources for development.
Thank you for that profound message to all of us. And would you be willing for people to contact you?
Sure,
you know,
absolutely.
In case they want some collaboration.
If you go to University of California, type the name Yilma, Y-I-L-M-A, I will pop out, because, you know, that's the only Yilma that I know on the university website. And I'm currently in the... I have a dual appointment right now, because my home department currently is medical microbiology, immunology in the School of Medicine, but I have a 50-50% appointment both in the medical school and the veterinary school. And I'm focusing on a lot of work. Currently, I chair my section in the National Academy of Science. I spend considerable amount of time on that. I'm also chair of the Board of International Science for National Academies. So I think that is the most prestigious organization in the United States, and I like to, my membership in that organization, I really would like to see what we can do in terms of technology transfer for developing countries.
Thank you again, Dr. De La Hoon.
Once
again, this is the Global Health Forum brought to you by People to People. My guest this evening was Professor De La Hoon Yilma, veterinary virologist at the University of California, Davis. We are coming to the end of our show, and thank you very much, Dr. De La Hoon, for sharing your precious time with us and for giving us such a productive discussion. We look forward to having you on this show again. And thank you all for tuning in, and mark your calendar for our next radio show next Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll have special presentation on mental health issues called Taboo No More. Dr. Jeffrey Hoffman will be hosting Dr. Jonas Geda, a professor of neurology and psychiatry at the Mayo Clinic College of Medicine. Dr. Geda will be discussing cognitive impairment and dementia. You can help us shape our program by submitting your comments and suggestions to info at people.org or P2P Facebook page. Remember, if you are unable to tune in live, you can access the archived show using the link on People to People website. I'm your host, Dr. Lydia Tesva. I'll be back with you third week of this month with another segment of Global Health Forum. Stay engaged.
Abby.
Thank you.